This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. The Penland School of Crafts in Mitchell County helped put North Carolina on the artisan map 75 years ago. By taking the crafts that had sustained the people in that region for generations, crafts such as weaving and woodworking, they encouraged, taught, and then made art out of the crafts at Penland. By some estimates, craft is a more than $500 million a year industry in North Carolina. There's Asheville, which has the third largest concentration of craft artists in the U.S., Seagrove in central North Carolina, where potters ply their trade in more than 100 potteries, and Columbia in the northeastern part of the state, where Pocosin Arts is working to emphasize regional crafts. As factories close and jobs are lost across North Carolina, some see craft and heritage tourism as a possible route to economic development. We welcome your calls this hour as we talk about craft in North Carolina. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Is North Carolina particularly hospitable to making craft and craft collecting a business? Could heritage tourism be the answer to some of the state's economic troubles? Joining us from the studios of WCQS in Asheville is Becky Anderson. She is Executive Director of Handmade in America. It's an organization that works to enhance the marketplace opportunities for craft. Thanks for being with us today, Becky Anderson.
Thank you. My pleasure indeed.
Welcome to The State of Things. Your work with Handmade in America, we should say right from the outset, is not to provide a how-to on how to make particular crafts, whether it be weaving or pottery, but on how to make a business out of crafts.
That's right. We are not makers of objects. We are not educators, and we're not schools of craft, and we're not museums or displayers or retailer. But we're here to say that the world of craft can become one of the many economic sectors that we believe are needed to shore up North Carolina's economy.
Mm-hmm. How can that happen? How can that be done?
Well, it's done through a variety of ways, and one of the ways we started out was to say that we wanted to put craft into every aspect of our region, and certainly we looked at Western North Carolina first. We wanted to imbue it into our educational aspect. We do a lot in the school systems, the university system. We wanted to put it into economic development, certainly as a key employer and a key contributor to the economy of the region. We wanted to put it into the world of tourism, which is a major aspect of Western North Carolina's economy and our state's economy at this time. And then we wanted to put it into the cultural life of our region also.
Mm-hmm. Now, the western part of North Carolina, if I'm looking at the numbers correctly, it has the strongest craft-based economy in the state. Now, why is that?
It's our legacy. It's our history. We didn't have to. This came to us naturally. It came as we were settled. It was the craft of function, the craft that worked, the pottery that people used, farm implements, tools, furniture, those kinds of things. And it came through our Celtic heritage of our Scots-Irish, our German ancestry that came here and brought their European flavor of craft. Then in the 40s and 50s, it was sort of the center of the contemporary work that came here when Black Mountain College was established. And many of the Bauhaus folks came here to Western North Carolina. We began the work of weaving and a contemporary design and a contemporary look that came with it. So interestingly enough, the region has this unique heritage of both the contemporary craft movement and the traditional craft movement of our country.
Yeah, because the numbers I'm seeing, by some estimates, there are about more than 6,000 people making their living through crafts in North Carolina, and about 4,500 of them are in the western part of the state.
A lot of them are. They really are. And part of that is also we had an education base here. And you go where there's an education base, you only have to look at our triad to see that. But we had the schools of craft. We had the John C. Campbell Folk School, the oldest folk school in the United States, continuing its operation. It's expanding every year and growing. We had the Penland School, of which you're going to pay tribute to later on in our conversation. We had the Haywood Community College, which was the first community college in the United States 40 years ago to put together a degreed program in the making of the work and the business of it. We had something called the Tryon Toy Makers that Edith Vanderbilt sponsored and sent women to Europe to learn how to make the wooden movable toys and came back and taught a whole town how to make them. So we have this long legacy of schools that are here, and when you have an education base, your economy follows that.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's one thing to make crafts, it's another to be able to sell them. Is it largely tourists who are buying this?
67% of our work here, we found out, is sold to the visitor that comes to the region. So we didn't have to create a market. The market was here. The question was, how do you expand that market? How do you create faithful returners who get affiliated and want to continue their purchasing power of it? We're looking at all new arenas now. We're looking, the third largest industry in Western North Carolina at this time is the construction industry. It's the housing, it's the second home, it's the retirement community, the golf course resort. They're everywhere in our region. And so we're now looking at a whole entirely new venue of placing craft in the construction, architecture, and interior design world.
How would that work? I mean, how would you manage to work craft into that? Are you talking about the actual building of
absolutely
of the house? Like, are we literally
absolutely
craftsman-style houses or just
well,
in the,
not
the
only
art?
Sure, it's that style, but it's staircase railings are made from wrought iron. It's fireplace screens, wrought iron, ceramic sinks, stained glass window inserts. You can use it in numerous ways in the construction of a house. We just finished a small 1,200 square foot, finely crafted affordable home here in Asheville to showcase that in the world of affordable housing. And had touches of craft. It can be tiles in the backsplash in the kitchen. It could be shelving. It can be, we added to the box cabinetry you buy from Lowe's, we added the work of wood turners. Handles, hinges, doorknobs. Craft has been an integral part of construction for a long time. We just need to make sure it's placed in venues that appreciate it, want its beauty, and will pay for it.
We're talking with Becky Anderson, who is director of Handmade in America. She is in Asheville. We welcome your calls this hour. The number is 1-877-962-9862. Joining us now, we have John Ellenbogen. He's a craftsman working in Western North Carolina in the town of Pentland. Now, 30 years ago, John Ellenbogen was a rocket scientist. Then he went to the Pentland School of Crafts and became a potter. And he's been since then an instructor at Pentland and has served 8 years on the school's board. And he's with us on the line from Pentland. Hi there, John Ellenbogen.
Hi, Melinda.
Hi. Well, the Pentland School of Craft has just come off its 75th anniversary. It has had a tremendous effect on craft in North Carolina, lots of people going there to teach or attend the school. Take us back, though. What was the original vision for the school at Pentland?
Lucy Morgan is the one who conceived the idea of Pentland School prior to 1929. And the concept was to preserve and enhance the local weaving skills so that local women, as we entered the Depression, could supplement their income and improve the quality of their work. Gradually over time, after the school was founded in 1929, crafts media were expanded to include wood and gem cutting and ceramics. And then she retired in 1962, and she appointed her successor, who was a man named Bill Brown, and she empowered him to transform the school into something new. So the transformation from strictly traditional crafts and a limited number of media took place starting in 62, and the school quickly morphed into an institution that was internationally renowned and covered virtually every craft. Today, Pentland teaches all the traditional crafts, but they'll go as far as teaching neon.
Okay, which might be traditional since maybe the 1940s or so, right? Would a lot of those crafts still be around if it had not been for Pentland? Would it have been able to survive in other places? What did Pentland contribute to preserving some of those older crafts?
I think that as manufactured items invaded people's homes, the reverence for the handmade object began to wane. I think Pentland's greatest accomplishment has probably been to keep in the public consciousness the fact that handmade objects in a person's life make their life richer and more meaningful. Just as an example of that, every morning when I get up, I look at that collection of mugs I have in my kitchen cupboard, and I think, which of my friends would I like to have breakfast with this morning? Mm-hmm. And I choose accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're a potter yourself, and you've been making a living at this. What was that transition like from being a rocket scientist to going to pottery?
Well, when I was working as a rocket scientist, it felt as if something was missing from my life, and I didn't know what that was. I came to Penland on a whim, took an 8-week class, and when that was over, I went back and quit my job and sold my car, boat, motorcycle, furniture, and moved to Penland and never left. My friends thought I was insane. I had given up great job security for a life of uncertainty and rejection. As an artist, you have to suffer a lot of rejection. But the fact is, I've never looked back, and I've never regretted the decision. I can't affect the level of my income in an upward direction very much, but the quality of my life is extraordinary, and I wouldn't exchange my life for anybody's.
Well, we want to continue talking with you in just a moment, John Ellenbogen, about whether these efforts to enhance the marketing for crafts has helped. We're talking with John Ellenbogen, a craftsman and teacher in Penland in Mitchell County, and Becky Anderson is with us. She is Executive Director of Handmade in America. We're talking about crafts as a business here in North Carolina. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. More of our conversation in just a moment. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkova. We're talking today about North Carolina crafts and their impact on communities and on the economy of North Carolina. By some estimates, North Carolina's economy gets about $500 million a year through the crafts that are done here in the state. We're joined by Becky Anderson, who's the executive director of Handmade in America. It's based in Asheville. Also on the line with us is potter John Ellenbogen, who has been an instructor at the Penland School of Crafts. Just before the break, John Ellenbogen, you were talking about having made that transition from being a rocket scientist to a potter, and this is how you make your living now. So I'm wondering if efforts such as Handmade in America, which has guidebooks for tourists to use if they want to go on to follow some trail for crafts, has that helped you?
It's helped enormously. The Craft Trails guidebook, which Handmade produced, resulted in an increase in our visitor traffic and sales in the very first year of its existence of between 20% and 30%.
So you're able to make a living at this then?
Well, it's funny. When you go back to your high school reunions after 20 or 30 years and people find out what you do, their first question is, can you make a living at that? It's been not very difficult to make a living at this. The kind of life we can make for ourselves, running our own small business and being our own boss, is a very rewarding and very attractive life.
Right. I want to ask you a question, though, about you're there in Penland, which you have a lot of people who would be coming through to enhance their ability at the craft, et cetera. You must get a lot of tourists coming through. Could you pick up and move to some other part of North Carolina with and have that same amount of success, or is it a matter of the place being very important?
What the place provides for us is a sense of community. There are probably 80 craft studios within 20 miles of Penland School. My studio is only 1 mile from the school, and virtually all of these people moved to the area because of an initial connection to Penland. Were the school to vanish, this community would remain and be very, very strong. I think there are other parts of the state where one can find community, a sense of community with other like-minded people, that would be satisfying and rewarding. But this one is certainly special.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, and what kind of work are you doing right now in terms of your pottery?
My wife, Rebecca Plummer, and I have always focused on functional pottery for everyday use. We make dinnerware and mugs and casseroles and things like that. We want to see these pots on people's tables every single day and in their dishwashers every single night.
Okay. And you'll be having dinner with them that way, right?
That is correct.
John Ellenbogen, thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
John Ellenbogen is a potter living in Pendland. We're talking about crafts in North Carolina. Is there something in your part of the state that makes it especially conducive to being a craftsman and being able to sell your wares? We have with us Becky Anderson, who is director of Handmade in America, an organization that tries to enhance the market. What are some of the challenges, Becky Anderson, outside of Western North Carolina, which seems to be this hotbed for crafts? What are some of the challenges elsewhere in the state?
There are challenges. And again, it goes back to, in some arenas of the state, it's not their history or their legacy. You cannot be who you're not. And I think people try to do a pseudo form and find that that doesn't last long and so forth. I think North Carolina is extraordinarily rich. You have the Seagrove area, which has its own legacy that this state has. I look at Pittsboro as one of those areas that has an emerging craft community and strong ties to it. Certainly, you're going to talk with Faith out at Cosin Arts Center, which has their own legacy. You've got the fabulous legacy of the coastal craft of the decoy museum, that where people make beautiful hand-carved duck decoys and seagrass basketry and those kinds of things. Again, all a part of where people live and what their legacy is. And for a lot of people, especially in the African-American community, you have that found work. That's where you have come to just using the materials at hand to make the things you need. There's an absolute artistry to me in a piece of string and wire, and people are very good at doing that too. So the state itself is very, very rich. I find myself in a lot of communities around the nation that struggle with this issue, and especially in the West, where distance is such an issue. And as John spoke so eloquently too, there's that community of like-minded people doing similar work that's very, very important to making it flourish and grow.
And you also have to have the foot traffic coming through,
yeah,
of people who would be willing to buy this.
To buy that. And tourism does play that major, major role in the purchasing of the work and so forth.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about crafts in North Carolina. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. Have you turned your family's trade into an art form with which you can make some money? Our number again, 1-877-962-9862. Joining us right now is Feather Phillips. She is founder of Pocosin Arts, based in Terrell County in Columbia in northeastern North Carolina. The arts organization is now in its 10th year, and some are calling it the Pendland of the East. Feather Phillips is on the line right now. Hi there, Feather.
Hi, Melinda. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, tell us about starting up Pocosin Arts there in Columbia, in Terrell County.
Well, I think it may have started at Pendland. I was a student at Pendland in the early 90s, and I found it to be a transformational experience. And I was teaching art in the nearby schools of Washington County and went away for 2 weeks and came back totally recharged and ready to go, and thought, wouldn't it be great to have this kind of opportunity in the eastern part of the state? Because if you've ever traveled border to border, you know it's quite a long state. I think Mankato Murphy, 550-some miles. And the mountains, of course, have Pendland and John C. Campbell and the North Carolina Center for the Advancement of Teaching. So those of us in the East who want that kind of refreshment and professional development have an additional challenge in the distance. So I came back and I thought, gee, wouldn't that be great? And about that time, Terrell County, working with the town of Columbia and the state and also our federal legislators were beginning to conceptualize a transformation of our community from farming, fishing, forestry to a growing tourism economy, mostly nature-based. And I thought, you know, the work I'd been doing with the children in the Crestville schools, focusing on their arts, the arts of their home, the quilts and carvings, the stories, the music, that work might have an application, and there might be a place for a complement to the nature-based tourism. So the idea of maybe a haven for artists, a haven for teachers, a place to honor local culture and share it with visitors. All of that was kind of swirling. And then as my 50th birthday approached in 1994, I decided to go for it and wrote a seed grant to the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation. And Tom Lambeth has been a mentor, and the foundation has been a great supporter of this vision.
So what kind of crafts are native in this part of the state that you'd be incubating there at Pocosin?
Well, of course, the traditional crafts that are shared across North Carolina, quilting, carving, more of a focus here on boat building, decoy carving that relates to this place. In the African-American community, carved walking sticks. The clay tradition here, because the eastern part of the state was a port, a lot of the ware was brought in on the ships, and so the need to produce pottery was not as strong as it may have been in the homesteads further west. But there is a clay tradition, Native American potteries through artifactual evidence, and some living Native Americans now recreating those traditions. But in the African American community, clay is dug, and these sort of gumbo heads are produced. So, the
gumbo heads,
finding the materials, making do with what is at hand, is a tradition that is still very alive here.
Mm-hmm. And gumbo heads, precisely, would be.
Well, they're a human head made out of clay and unfired, and they may be used for ornament, or they may be used in some sort of sacred way in a traditional African practice.
Right. And so this was very important also because, as you mentioned, Tyrrell County had been relying on natural resources for its economy, and it's one of the poorest counties in the state, what they call a Tier 1 county. So how much of an impact can Pocosin Arts have on the economy there? I mean, do you have any evidence yet that it's helped out?
Well, I can tell you, I did a little chart today of what Main Street Columbia looked like when Pocosin Arts began and what it looks like today. And there's been quite a change. Of about 20 buildings in the downtown section, there are about half of them that have been either restored or renewed or have a new life. And we have, when Pocosin Arts started, we had, about 10 buildings were either partially used or not used and boarded up and tilted, and it was kind of a sad scene. And now we have a very high-end gift shop and an ice cream shop, a Mexican tienda, two working restaurants, Pocosin Arts Gallery, a new pet store, our teaching studios, an historic home which is being redone, the blacksmith store, there was a bakery, and the town and county have done a boardwalk and a park and a North Carolina Visitor Center and a Pocosin Lakes National Wildlife Refuge Visitor Center. So there are a lot of partners that are influencing the growth and change in Pocosin Arts, or in the community. Pocosin Arts is a part of that. Mm-hmm. And Highway 64, which is a major east-west highway, has now been expanded to four lanes through our community. And we're trying desperately to get visitors on their way to the Outer Banks to turn left and drive one block and experience this wonderful little town.
All right. And I'm wondering, though, Feather, when you got started with Pocosin Arts, because there had been nothing like that in that northeastern part of the state, on the mainland side, at least, was it difficult to get people to recognize that indeed they had a craft that might be worth selling and making some money with?
Yeah, I think, you know, and the consciousness among a lot of local people is, you know, taking it for granted. I think people value their family quilts. They value things that were made in the family, but in a different way, not necessarily in a way that you might put a price tag on something like that and sell it to a total stranger from a faraway state. They value it for all of the sentimental reasons, you know, the attachment to family and so on. But I think when you put what has been on somebody's bed on a wall and give credit to that, all of a sudden there's a new appreciation for family work and for ourselves and each other.
Okay. Well, Feather Phillips, thank you for being with us today.
It's delighted to be here.
Feather Phillips is founder of Pocosin Arts in Columbia in Tyrrell County in northeastern North Carolina. We're talking about crafts in the state today. And if you want to join the conversation, our number is 1-877-962-9862. Mark joins us on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how's it going?
Fine. Welcome to the program.
Great. I had occasion to be in Seagrove, and I was in Seagrove looking around, just looking to see what Seagrove was. And I was very impressed with all the little houses turned into shops and studios and things like that. It was real interesting. And then later on, right around Thanksgiving, I had occasion to be in Asheville at Biltmore Village, to be exact. And I was looking around the shops there looking for some artsy, crafty, seasonal things, some Christmas things, things like that. And I went into this one shop and started looking around, saw some real nice things, and saw a beautiful quilt hanging there on a display. And I'm just the kind of person that I looked at these items real carefully, and everything in that shop and the surrounding shops were made in China. And that was very disappointing. And the funny thing, you were just talking about quilts handed down through the family, but when I talked to the owner of the store, the lady in the store, she acted like she was very surprised that it was made in China. I said, well, maybe just the label's made in China. I'm not sure, but it says
that's a generous interpretation.
Yeah, I was trying to be nice.
Well, Becky Anderson?
Well, I was a little surprised. I'm sitting here thinking, I'm rapidly going through my mind thinking, where was he and what shops? Because I know the shops in Biltmore Village and the Bellagio shop and the New Morning Gallery and the Glass Vitrine Place, all of those. Now, we did suffer our flood, so some of those are temporarily closed. But they're all certainly made here in the U.S. and have a focus, a major focus of craft from Western North Carolina or the state of North Carolina. And then because we can't meet the demand, there are 37 galleries and shops of craft in Asheville alone from all over the country. Mm-hmm. But that's very true, and therein is the struggle I think that the economy of this country struggles with is how do we take our own work from within this country and keep it on the forefront and keep it vibrant and keep it a part of everybody's life. How do we deal with the import issue and so forth? So, I mean, he's hit upon probably the key element that we're facing in a national economy as well. But I'm a little surprised, I have to confess, because I pretty well know Biltmore Village upside down and inside out, and so I'm trying to think where that could be.
Well, Mark, good of you to look at the labels.
Yeah, it was one of the ones that hadn't been flooded out, and I looked at several of the ones that the remaining ones that were open, and it was almost exclusively made in China. I was very disappointed.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your call, Mark.
Thank you.
1-877-962-9862 is the number. We're talking about crafts in North Carolina today. And one place where the crafts have been going for some time is Seagrove in central North Carolina. This is a community that benefited early on from an early idea of heritage tourism that began early in the 20th century. Some of the artists who live and work at Seagrove are 6th and 7th generation potters. Ben Owen III is on the line with us now. He's descended from a long line of potters, the Owen family, one of the first potting families in the Seagrove area in the 1700s. Thanks for being with us, Ben.
Oh, thank you. Glad I could be a part of it.
Well, I understand you learned your trade from your grandfather, is that right?
That's correct. I learned early on and spent time after school and on weekends working with my grandfather, who had retired from his profession as being a craftsman in clay. And being a potter, it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's your livelihood, and you think about it constantly, about all different parts of what you want to do. But I learned early on from my grandfather a lot of the basic necessities and being a good potter and having an eye for form and design. And he was such a great mentor to me to be able to learn in that environment, which was, as you look back on it today, is kind of unusual. But we were very fortunate to have other facilities like Penland School of Crafts and John C. Campbell Folk Art School and other places like we have here now in Seagrove called the North Carolina Pottery Center, where we're trying to educate people about handmade items, specifically clay.
Mm-hmm. Now, your family, going back, has been potting in the Seagrove area since the 1700s. I understand it was really good clay in that area, naturally found clay, that attracted people to begin with. But The need for those pots that people were making kind of tapered off in the early part of the 20th century when the Industrial Revolution was in full gear, mass production of plates came along. What was it that kept the pottery alive in Seagrove while it kind of fell off in so many other places?
Well, there are a lot of different influences that were a factor in really making it a survival or reviving the tradition in our community and specifically the Seagrove area. But the Industrial Revolution did play a factor in as far as everyday staple items that people would use for storage or before all the changes happened where people could go out and buy these mass-produced type items, whether they're glass or metal or in the sense of ceramics being produced in an industrial level. People would use those storage type jars for before Prohibition, the whiskey jugs and those kinds of things, of course, that was a big demand because they had to have something to put the whiskey in. But other staple items for using serving food, preserves, and other type items really were the main demand. But the changing point was when people from outside, some integral people who had discovered this area and found some of these potters still working and making some things with the local clay and for their own use, and also trading with other merchants for other staple items they needed for the home. They saw that this was really a dying craft, and they really felt like, this would be a way to, let's find a way to really help this continue on, this tradition on. And Jock and Juliana Busby, who created Jugtown Pottery, and other people who, North State Pottery, and several other potteries around the area, the Cole family, which has a really rich heritage in this area.
Ben, we're going to get back to more of the history of Seagrove in just a moment. We have to take a quick break. Ben Owen is with us. He is a potter in the Seagrove Pottery community. Also with us, Becky Anderson with Handmade in America. Just ahead, more of your calls at 1-877-962-9862. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We're talking this hour about crafts and the craft industry in North Carolina. Becky Anderson is here. She is director of Handmade in America. Also with us on the line is potter Ben Owen III. He's a descendant of one of the longtime potting families from Seagrove, the Seagrove area in the central part of North Carolina. Just before the break, you were talking about how, I guess it was in the 20s or so, there were people who came in from away, the Busby family, I think they're from New York, and they saw what was happening in Seagrove. It was an appreciation for the pottery that used to be just utilitarian, and they saw that as craft. And they gave a showcase to it, didn't they?
That is correct, but they brought with them an eye for what was going on in other parts of with the arts and crafts movement and other influences in other parts of the United States and other countries. They drew from, they were really looking at other ideas and other visions for the style of pottery that was being made in this area. So not just the utilitarian nature, but they worked with the potters and introduced more vibrant colors and more shapes that would be ornate or decorative in nature. And from there, they were able to still continue to, because of the handmade item, they could offer it to the public for sale in a utilitarian nature, but then also they could accent their mantle or their table in a way to enhance their home.
When we talk about Seagrove pottery, is there something distinctive about all the pottery that is made in that area, or is it just because it comes from that place? I mean, if you looked at a piece, would you say, oh, that's a Seagrove work?
Well, there are several distinctive styles out of the Seagrove area from these family traditions, and some of them are the traditional forms that were derived from English and German backgrounds, as well as the outside influences. And a lot of people find it surprising who have just first discovered the Seagrove area. They see these kind of Asian style or more forms that would commonly be seen in museums that come from other countries such as China or Japan or Korea, and even Middle Eastern, more Mesopotamian type forms that were derived from early even biblical type forms, like a Rebecca pitcher that some of the potters make in this area that reminds Rebecca the well. And So there are some distinctive shapes. The functional pieces are very familiar. The people get to know the work of the area, and they can see some similarities in the style and the way things are made, such as a bean pot or a pie plate or a pitcher. But I think the clay from the area, the distinctiveness of using the clay from the area, and just the long line of tradition that has been here has been kind of a signature thing. It has been a drawing card for people coming to this area. 20, 25 years ago, there were only a dozen potteries here, but now there are over 100 potteries in our area, and there are people that have moved here who have not just studied from local potters, but also have been to school and actually studied in a formal setting.
Well, Ben Owens, thank you for taking time out from your pottery today to talk with us.
Oh, thank you.
Ben Owen III is a potter living in Seagrove in central North Carolina. We're talking about the crafts here in the state. And joining us is Deetha, who's in Smithfield. Hi there, Deetha.
Yes.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I live in Smithfield. I am a handcrafter. I make wooden welcome signs. And aside from festivals, flea markets, and a little consignment shop that I'm about to connect with, I'm finding it difficult to market my craft, and I'm just trying to find more effective ways and ideas to be able to get my handcraft out there.
Okay, well, Becky Anderson probably is the person to talk to. She's director of Handmade in America. Becky?
Well, I was trying to, I was thinking of the location, and again, you're right, hooking into the tourism market is generally the way a lot of people get there. And I think in Smithfield, I think working with some of your local venues where tourism, where folks stop, and I'm placing in my mind what she's making and thinking, again, those are very functional, useful things that she's making, and it might be that going into the retail world and even shops and places that are there to support welcoming signs, I think would be at housing and so forth. Again, I'm back into this very functional use of things. But I would check around, and most people do sell, by the way. About 50% of most craft sales are through craft shows and fairs and that kind of thing. So she's probably in that bigger arena.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but
maybe
I think I would.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I would look at things like garden shops and so forth that use these kinds of signage, and think of different places that might be glad to have something uniquely made from there and from the Smithfield area.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps Deetha can take advantage of all the tourists who stop off in Smithfield on their way down 95 for the outlet
That's
malls.
That's right.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Becky Anderson.
Thank you for asking.
Becky Anderson is Executive Director of Handmade in America. And thanks to our other guests, John Ellenbogen, a potter and former board member of the Penland School of Crafts, Feather Phillips, founder and director of Pocosin Arts, Ben Owen, potter in Seagrove. Now, for more information on crafts from the North Carolina Arts Council, go to www.discovercraftnc.org. And also, the Penland exhibit is at the Mint Museum in Charlotte through the 30th of January. It marks their 75th anniversary and has more than 100 pieces showing the history and the arts that have come out of Penland. That's at the Mint Museum in Charlotte. The artists Picasso, Matisse, Degas, and Rodin will be leaving the state soon. For the past few months, works by those artists have been on display as part of the Matisse, Picasso, and School of Paris exhibit at the North Carolina Museum of Art. That exhibit closes this Sunday. To let more people get one last peek at the works, the museum is staying open through the night on Saturday. That's 32 straight hours from 9 a.m. Saturday morning to 5 p.m. Sunday. There is a lot to see there and to comment upon. We hear from some folks who were there last weekend as they absorbed the works of Van Gogh, Degas, Rodin, and the rest.
I see three figures. I can almost imagine that one of the trees with its leaves might represent another larger image of a woman's face.
Her face looks like the same face on the woman that is over there. The same with the other one. I think it's Reclining Nude 3. I think that one's it.
It kind of does, in a way, look a little bit like home. With the, if these were pine trees and say you were at a point or something looking out on the Sound.
It's so real. I think she's pleased with herself, and she's doing the dance in her mind.
He looks like he's very lost in thought. And then it's the colors, the hues, the dark, the kind of copper browns and tans.
At first I would have thought that it was chalk and not crayon. Well, not chalk, but maybe more like a pencil than a crayon. You know, you don't really think of them using something so simple as a crayon. Like, okay, did it in crayon.
Well, we were actually looking for sculptures of men because we didn't see very many in the exhibit, and this was the first one we came across.
Well, we're just wondering why the statue is not finished anatomically and what that says about Rodin's understanding of Balzac.
It's also strange that the hands aren't ever shown. I wonder why that is.
Visitors enjoying the Matisse, Picasso, and School of Paris exhibit at the North Carolina Museum of Art. The museum will stay open for 32 consecutive hours this weekend. The exhibit closes on Sunday at 5. Back in 1968, the Asheville Post Office hired its very first female mail carrier. Judy Morris was the second lady mailman ever to be hired in North Carolina, and when she retired from the job in the past month after 36 years as a courier, she was the longest-serving woman to deliver mail in North Carolina. Judy joins us now on the line from Asheville. Thanks for being with us today, Judy Morris.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
When you first began working for the post office as a mail carrier in 1968, I guess you had never seen a woman deliver mail yourself before.
No, I hadn't.
So what prompted you to go and get a job as a mail carrier?
Well, I had been a stay-at-home housewife and mother, and for whatever reason, I decided to take the exam. And I took the exam, passed the exam, and then 2 years later, during the 2 years, I had been offered a couple of jobs, but most of them were clerk jobs, which meant I had to work in the middle of the night, and I lived about 20 miles away. So with small children and a husband, that just did not seem too well. So at the end of the 2 years, when my test expired, I took the test again. So the second test is what I was hired from.
So I guess the second time was the charm.
The second time apparently was, but by the second time, I needed to go to work.
And you got a job. They gave you a mail bag and a uniform?
At first, I did not have a uniform. You have to work 90 days in order to get your uniform allotment. Mm-hmm. So they had just approved slacks for ladies. The dress for ladies included a pillbox hat and also inch-and-a-half flat shoes.
Wow. And this was a walking route, we should point out.
This was walking. I did not get around to ordering the high-heel shoes, and I didn't order the pillbox hat. But the other thing we had was a 100% wool thing like a tam. Well, I wore that some during the winter, but by the time the spring rolled around, I had a what you would call a bus driver's hat that had my badge on it. Mm-hmm. And we were required to wear a hat at all times.
So how did your fellow mailmen respond?
Well, a lot of the men, for the majority, they were all very helpful, and a lot of the men were older, and they treated me like a daughter or a sister. And, of course, you had a few that did not take too great to the idea of a female doing their job, as they said, a man's job. They would make little sly remarks, something like, I don't want a woman around doing a man's job, or some at that point, you know, they could pretty much say whatever. It's not like it is now, you know, they can't do that.
So were there any times when you felt people were really surprised to see a woman?
Yes, very much so. In the early years when I was delivering to an apartment complex, the lady came to the door as I approached, and she says, "Oh, please wait just a minute. I would like to get my husband up from his nap because I told him that you were here yesterday, and he wanted to get up to meet you."
So did you wait, and he kind of...
I did. I waited, uh-huh.
And what was his reaction?
I don't even remember at that point. They were a retired couple, and they had moved here, I think, from out of town, and they thought that was very interesting to move into town and have a female carrier.
I would imagine that after a while you just got a little bit blasé when people would do a double take to see
right,
a woman.
Right, right. I could tell you a funny story, though.
Oh, please do.
I was carrying mail at a different complex one day, and as I approached the door, the woman who was just inside the door jumped behind the door as I walked up on the porch, and she peeped around the door, and she says, "Oh, I thought you were the mailman." And she was very scantily clad.
Well, when you started with the post office, could you do anything that the men could do there?
The only thing I could not do was deliver special delivery after dark, which would include possibly working till midnight and going to residences or businesses when it was dark and late. That was the only thing my postmaster would not let me do.
Did they eventually let you do that?
Oh, no, never. We actually do not have special delivery now. We have priority mail, but if anybody delivers it that late, I'm not aware of it.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of route did you have?
When I first started, the first 2 weeks I worked, going to work right before Christmas, the only thing that I did at that point was make collections from your street boxes, you know, where you pick up the outgoing mail. It was probably 7 years before I had my own route.
How much weight would be on your shoulder in terms of the mail you were carrying?
Supposedly 35 to 40 pounds was the maximum, but a lot of times you had more than that because so many people in the residential areas got lots and lots of magazines and catalogs, and we had samples like cereal samples, soap samples, which they don't do anymore, but we had lots of those then.
Were you delivering mail until you retired recently?
Yes.
Why did you decide to retire?
Well, it's 6 years past my retirement, and I decided it was time to retire and be able to enjoy living a little bit more before I got too old to enjoy it.
Is there something about your job you're going to miss?
I am definitely going to miss my customers. I looked forward to seeing them every day, and I think the majority of those looked forward to seeing me, and I've had lots of phone calls and letters and cards and everything telling me how much they were missing me.
Well, thank you for your pearls of wisdom. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, but I really am going to miss seeing my customers, and I really did like my job carrying mail.
Well, Judy Morris, thank you again for talking with us.
And thank you.
And for today, that's the state of things. Thank you for listening. If you have a comment about the program, you can drop us an email here. That address is sot@wunc.org. Our program is directed by Keith Weston, edited by Dave DeWitt, and produced by Jordana Gustafson and Corey Princell. Al Wodarski is our technical director. Susan Davis is the senior producer, and the executive producer is Fred Wasser. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Melinda Pencava.